Have to wait till the echo goes on. Yes. So let's get going. We're going to try to wrap up some stuff. So there's still some people out that have to take the test. So I wouldn't talk about it too much with everybody. And then as soon as they're done, then I'll run all the Scantrons so I don't have to bring those if I can. And then I'll put the Scantrons up. They should send that back to me relatively quickly. I'll get the Scantron scores up. It takes a little time to grade what your response questions. 100 students, okay? So I'm going through that. Hopefully with enough camps during the exam, the essays will be a little bit easier to grade because we tried to give you some hints to who thinks of the right answers. And hopefully you didn't find the exams too hard, but, you know, in case people are still taking the exam, you know, it was really rough, right? And you got hand cramps and all that, and stress afterwards, went home and cried for hours. Okay. So, anyway, so we'll wait. We'll talk about the exam. But some of you had questions about something that was on a lecture that we had on Tuesday, which wasn't on the exam on Monday, but I'm throwing out that question so I can talk about it anyway. So everybody got 2 points at least to start with. And that was because we didn't cover about crocodiles having two atrium, two ventricles, right? So that question you all got, because we covered that on Tuesday in the Monday section. That question was also on a Monday quiz or test. So anyways, that one we gave you. But now we know it, the answer for that. So that one won't even be graded. All right. But I'm not reducing, making all the other questions worth more. I'm just giving you that one right off the bat.
If we got the questions, we get the 2 points plus 2 points.
No.
That's a good one.
No, we just won't grade that. You just got the 2 points off. Right. Okay. But there were more. There's more than 100 points on the test. So you're going to have, you know, hopefully everybody has 100, 102, or whatever it is that you have for that test. Okay? Does that handle the test stuff? Hopefully all the tests will be done relatively soon, and then I can get up the essays, but I'll start grading those and then drop all those in. Hopefully the average is pretty high. And what else we talked about to get the 80 points in lecture, if you go through your syllabus, there's 80 points that we have. So how those 80 points come up in the next couple days, let's see, where are we? We are here at 4-4. Oh, I need to put the podcast up. I just didn't upload the new web page, but it's. I'll have that posted right there, and the Echo's already online with the Canvas. So what happens today, we'll put that in there, podcast. And then next Tuesday, we don't have class. You get a whole day off. But it's not quite that easy. So I like to torture you all. And so I'm going to record an Echo 360 from where we leave off today, put that online. I'll probably put it on the web page because I have to record it on a personal capture on my laptop. And then I'll upload it to this web page because I can't put it in the Canvas the way I'll record it because I'm not going to be here on that Tuesday. And then what we'll do is have something on here since there's no lecture on the 9th, next Tuesday. Don't come to class unless you just want to. And we'll have some online kind of quiz over the material on that Echo, so I know that you've actually listened to it. And that'll be kind of fun because then you know what happens to your classmates that aren't here, that don't come to lecture, and you'll see how they're catching their content. Inside joke. So the quiz will be about that, okay? It'll be online. It'll be open for a long period of time. And the main point I'm trying to get in physiology is that you learn the content, not that, you know, I'm trying to stress you out on exams or anything. So I don't care if you get together and work it out, but then, you know, you'll have this content and it'll go over the material to make sure that you know this material, okay? So that's okay. So it's not going to be like a time thing. I'm just going to leave it open, but you'd have one time through it. Maybe we can make it where you have two times through it. I have to figure out how to do that in Canvas. I used to know how to do it in Blackboard. I'm not quite sure how to do it in Canvas. Okay, so there'll be something on that content that'll be on the Echo, all right? And that'll go over for a while. And then we come back on the Thursday. We'll go over the exam, make sure everybody's got that. And then later on, I can't give quizzes during Dead Week because I got in trouble with that last year. even though it was an extra quiz to give people extra points. But anyways, so we won't give a quiz during Dead Week, but we're going to give two quizzes the week before Dead Week, right? So it's going to be a little busy. And then we'll have a three-point assignment to make sure we get up to the 80 points, okay? Because remember, you had two one-pointers at the very beginning of the semester, right? So this will make that five, and then the first quiz was five, and so then this will make you 3 points, and you get the 80 points. Hopefully this will buffer the CCR grades a bit, because I know that's been rugged and really rough. So hopefully this will help balance it a bit and bring up some averages, okay? Does that sound good? Are we all on the same page? Yes? Yes? Right? Yes? Okay. All right. Let's get going on this stuff. Okay. So, we kind of left off somewhere here. All right. So, we're going to wrap up circulation, and we're going to get into respiratory. They all kind of go together, and we are going a bit rapid with this, because actually the PowerPoints, there's extra content in this PowerPoint to kind of put it in context for you. So if you're just looking at the PowerPoints, that'll be helpful to get all the rest of the information. But I'm hitting the main points on these PowerPoints. Some of them have a bit more information than what we need to really know, but it pulls it all together and makes it a little bit more in context. Okay, so we went through the frog. How many chambers does a frog have? You did that lab already in the heart. Three, right? Like two atria and one ventricle, but with a kind of a developing of a septum. It can kind of go one direction or the other, but it's not completely off. So just think of that septum continually growing up, you know, and then making four chambers. And then we get into the birds and the mammals with complete four-chambered heart, two atrium, two ventricles. All right? And we see that generally, as even in the frog, right? The two atrium and the one ventricle and that septum kind of separating out the blood to the gas exchange organ, right? And then the systemic circulation. And when you get to the four-chambered, it's really one side really working for the respiratory system, right? And then the other one for the systemic circulation. And then you see the left side of the heart usually developing more stronger pressure system to get the fluid out to the blood out to the systemic circulation, all that tissue that's out there. Okay, and we'll pull that together towards the end of the class or the end of the course with other aspects as well. So in the fetus, when you're developing, pretty neat, right? You don't need to be respiring, right? And your lungs are not, you're not breathing with your lungs, right? They're developing. So you get the oxygenation from your mother. Does the blood exchange between the mother and the infant? No, right? So it's just a gas exchange across it, and then through the placenta, and then bring oxygen into the fetal blood, and then the fetal blood carrying it around the fetus. But they found some really interesting things. It used to be like there was never any exchange of any content between the mother and the fetus. And then it's changed a lot over the years. So some really interesting aspects, just, and it's not in your text, but just something fun to, you know, pay attention to. There was a group in Hong Kong, I believe, where they actually were testing the mother's blood and found bits of DNA of the fetus. And that was pretty cool, because then they could think about, oh, maybe we don't have to do anisocytosis, where we would take a needle and go into the fetus tissue and take out a little bit of tissue out and then look to see if there was any genetic problems that you might need to know about. Instead, they could take blood out of the mother, because when the DNA breaks down of the infant, or the fetus, sorry, that would then get in mother's circulation, and they could use that to test. So that was pretty cool. Big breakthrough. And so I don't know where that field's gone right now, but it's kind of neat. Maybe we can do something about that later. And I think we all know about smoking and medications that can get into the mother, right? So that's some that are in the mother that then get into the fetus. And so there's lots of issues with that. But pretty neat to think about. So there are some exchanges in exomes. Anybody hear about exomes these days? Didn't we talk about exomes one time? We talked about the nervous system. Anybody hear about exomes before? Yes? No? Exomes? Nothing? Okay, so exomes are the big new thing that everybody's really focusing on. Exomes are like these vesicles, they are vesicles, that bud off of tissue, like your skeletal muscle. And that exome can then travel to another tissue and fuse in and exchange material from one tissue type to another tissue type are different cells in the body. They found that with muscle, and there's a group here on campus that's actually isolating exomes and skeletal muscle in rodents under different conditions to find out if there's exchange of information. They now think that metastases and cancers are probably transferred through exomes as well. So it's a big thing for oncology right now as well to start looking at. But they did find a number of years back, just I think it was 2 years ago, exomes in the brain. So that means neurons, it's not a synaptic vesicle, but it's content in the nerve that can actually then bud out, basically, like a little vesicle, and then travel and maybe then fuse into another cell because it's a lipid membrane, right? A little vesicle. So it's really interesting. If you hear about exomes, at least then you're not completely caught off guard. You've heard of it because this is where the field's really growing quite quickly. And there's so much about it. So they think that exomes might actually be transferred from the fetus to the mother and mother to the fetus as well. So that's a whole new gamut of information that people are beginning to look at. So at least that you've heard about it, and you can kind of think about all the issues that go along with that. So it's pretty neat. Okay, and then we talked about in the fetal development, you have the way the heart develops, since you don't need to push blood through the lungs because it's not developed yet. It's kind of the last tissue to really develop. That you bypass it with a hole in between the two atrium, between the right atrium and the left atrium, called foramen ovale. And so that pushes blood over to the left side, and then out to the systemic circulation. And also, if some blood's going up the pulmonary artery, there's another branch over, right? The ductus arteriosus. So it branches blood from the pulmonary artery over to the aorta, so it can bypass the lungs again. So that's pretty neat. But they should close after you're born. And if they don't close, that's what is referred to as a blue baby. So is a blue baby due to foramen ovale, or is it due to a patent ductus arteriosus? And so that's what people check out and to find out what the issue might be. Okay, so we know this now. Okay, and I know this is too hard to read, but what this is just up there for your content if you're interested. This, and this isn't in your textbook, but it's kind of fun because we just talked about it a little bit. As you develop your circulatory system, you as a fetus, when you were a fetus, you had like 6 gill arches. And a number of those gill arches close off. They're ligaments in you as an adult. And some of those gill arches stay open. That makes your aorta. So this is why you hear sometimes, as I mentioned last time, an aorta might not go off the left side. It actually might go off the right side. So it's kind of interesting. Some people do have an inverted aorta. And that ductus arteriosus is one of these. It's number 6, I think. This one right here, this gill arch right here from the pulmonary artery over to the aorta. It closes off, and it's just a ligament in you now. But it closes off due to oxygen and pressure change as you're born. So think of a preemie, right? If a preemie, born prematurely, they might have some problems. One big problem is a surfactant in their lungs because their lungs didn't make surfactant yet. Another issue might be that these ductus arteriosus in the foramen ovale, right? Because of the conditions, the way they might have been born. Okay, and how premature they are. So it's really interesting if you're interested in OBGYN or pediatrics later on, these kind of issues. Okay, so the ductus arteriosus main thing. If you want to think about then in a fetus development, they're getting oxygenation from the mother, right, the placenta. So a question that a long time ago used to be on a Kaplan test bank. But it was about in the fetal blood circulation. I don't know if they still do it. If anybody's taking the test or study, see if they still have that kind of question. The fetal blood, where is the highly oxygenated blood coming to the heart? Is it the left atrium, like you would think, or is it the right atrium, right? Because it's coming to the heart, right? So it's highly oxygenated coming into the heart on the right side. So just something to think about. And then out to the systemic circulation after it goes through the heart. So I don't know, anybody take Kaplan test or test MCAT thing? Do they still have this fetal development stuff in the test banks still there? Okay, so that's interesting to think about, just that you're not caught off guard. Okay, I just tried this link and it went down on me, so I will give you some other links. Maybe we'll do something for that with a three-pointer or something to do with one of the quizzes. And it's pretty neat because you can listen to some of these heart sounds, and it's really interesting to listen to. Okay, so indomethacin. Anybody know what indomethacin is, right? You might take that for pain, joint pains, or something like that. But it's a prostaglandin inhibitor, right? So this is kind of interesting because in humans, I put this whole thing in there. It's postnatally, indomethacin can be used to help close the ductus arteriosus. And so they might give that to the fetus to help close it. But what happens in the mother, if the mother takes it, right? So ductus arteriosus can also close in uterine because of the mother taking indomethacin. So that can be an issue. And fetus, these infants exposed, or fetus exposed to this prenatal indomethacin, were more likely to have need surgical ligation of the ductus arteriosus. So that's kind of interesting because then they wouldn't respond later on to it because the mother has already been taking it. So interesting things to kind of think about. Maybe watching out what one takes when they're developing a little infant inside of them, little fetus inside of them. It's pretty interesting, you know, that you talk about the heart rate. That's part of the issues today politically too, about when the heart beats and when does life start and all that good stuff. So you can actually hear this very early on, just 21 days after conception, right? So it really starts very early on. You can imagine you need to get that blood and oxygenation and nutrients to the developing tissue. So that develops relatively quick. But they can pick up abnormalities relatively quick too because of it not working right or not pacing right. So they can hear that heart rate over the mother's, right, because it's beating a lot faster than the mother, so you hear a fast beat and then a slower beat of the mother. So if you think of that embryonic heart rate, look at that, 165 to 185 beats per minute. My God, it's like a little hummingbird. You know, really fast. Try counting that rate, and it's really fast, right? And so it's amazing that little heart just pumping away. And, you know, then it starts to slow down, and then they actually have a formula. You don't have to memorize this. I just wanted to show you. So you can actually predict maybe the age of the fetus in a normal development. So it's kind of interesting. They have these neat graphs that you could actually see. Do you fall in this range? Here's a scatter of many people, 9,000-something, 43. But you can see that it should follow this trajectory pretty well and then see how it progresses. So you can pretty much estimate the development of that fetus and what age it is in weeks. So that's kind of cool. Just something fun. There's a lot of diseases, and this isn't in your textbook, but just to mention some of these because you might hear of it, and there's they happen quite often. It's not too rare, some of these. But there's a whole list, and I know it's really hard to read, and you don't have to memorize this. Some of these things we'll go over, but I just put it all up there because I know some of you are interested in allied health, and some people are interested in cardiac. But there's some of these that are more common than other cases, like this tautology of Follett. It's really four different conditions that happen, and so it's really quite interesting. The septum doesn't develop right. The aorta region doesn't develop right. So there's like these four cases, and now they've linked these to genes that are defective or altered. And then there's, think about a pulmonary stenosis. If the pulmonary artery didn't open up well, you couldn't get blood to go to the after you're born, right? So that could happen. And that seems to be a higher incidence as well. Ventricular septal defects. Think of how many cases this has happened. So where the ventricle doesn't develop completely right. But nowadays they can go and do surgery and correct a number of these cases, but some of them they just can't deal with. You don't have to memorize this, but I think it went off the chart here. Let's see, I can put some up here maybe. Let's see, went off the chart. Let's see what happened here. Let's just move that up, move our little heart picture up. Okay. But if they can correct it, if they can catch it early, you can see all these problems. Pulmonary stenosis, ventricle, septal defect. The aorta doesn't ride right over the left ventricle. It's misdeveloped. And right ventricle hypertrophy, some problems. But if they correct it earlier, mortality is less than 3%, but you can imagine you'd have to be at a hospital or somewhere where they could do that surgery, right? So, or be aware of it. So pretty interesting. So a lot of these cases are kind of neat, but still some of the problems, mortality, you know, for some of these, like various types of the heart just doesn't develop, that mortality could be higher. And so some problems, that's all they can really do. Anybody know what animal that they use sometimes for heart transplants?
It's a pig.
They use a pig for like the valves sometimes, like pig valves. So because the valves fits our valves pretty much. Now they have mechanical valves. The problem in U of L actually came forward and really tried quite a bit of different mechanical valves. And it was really quite interesting. They've perfected some in their engineering with cardiac research. And they developed, the problem with the old valves is that they were too stiff and they would damage the red blood cells. And they would start lysing red blood cells. And so that was a problem. Then they developed valves that had more like a tissue structure to them and they're a little bit softer and they weren't damaging the red blood cells. So that's pretty cool. So there's a whole field out there if you're interested in engineering and medicine and health. Think where you can go, right? Some really neat aspects. For some of the other heart transplants, they actually use a baboon heart. And because the baboon heart is about the size of a human heart. So they can put that in temporarily if they're waiting for a donor heart, for example. So this is something about your back of your driver's licenses if you sign it. I know it's always a fear that might not be dead and they already harvest your organs, right? But they really do check you out pretty well that you're, you know, you can write in there, if I'm brain dead, what do you want the rest of your tissues for, at least in my view. So you can think about people that could use tissues if you're not using it anymore. Just something to think about. So interesting that they would use baboon hearts or temporary hearts for a while. Okay. So you can really pick up a lot of these heart abnormalities. Remember we talked about the EKG and it's so powerful and non-invasive. You can pick up a lot of that. SIDS, you know, sudden infant death syndrome, you probably heard of that, right? There's a lot of controversy with that, and a lot of papers that have been written on that. And what's the take-home? Does anybody know the absolute take-home on any of that? No, because they still are out in debate. What really causes SIDS? Some people think it always happened to do with an infant that was overheated, maybe swaddled too heavily with the cloth. Usually that's the cases with a lot of the SIDS. Maybe it had to do with they're face down in a pillow and the CO2 is building up too much and the pH drops, as well as being hot. And so there's a lot of controversy with this. In California, when the infant dies and they think of SIDS, it's sent to a pathologist to actually try to find out what the cause might be. Is it an abnormality, maybe in response to CO2, an abnormality in the heart? Is there some kind of genetic link that they can look at? And then they actually send some of that tissue to a group in Boston. And this gal in Boston, she's like the goddess of SIDS, and she tries to look through the genetic profiles of these infants that died from that. And you can imagine some of it gets into legal issues because maybe the parents weren't, you know, wanting the child, maybe they suffocated. So they actually want to find out about these cases and see more about it. But they've noticed that there's some QT interval, the prolonged QT, remember? PQRST wave, that longer interval, that would be the time for repolarization to the ventricle. So there might be some links to the heart abnormality. I just bring that up. Okay, so we talked about electrical flow before and the differences in action potentials through the heart. And if you think about that heart contraction, what happens to all that calcium that comes in there that has to come out, right? Where does calcium come from? You know, both regions, the sarcoplasmic reticulum and across the plasma membrane. But that has to work pretty quick, like we talked about with the rattlesnake shaker muscle, but that's skeletal muscle, not to get confused, right? It has to be taken up quickly in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in the heart, like smooth muscle, calcium is from extracellular as well as intracellular from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So you can think of all these channels regulating calcium at the same time, but then the calcium pumps and other kinds of exchangers, like here's a plasma membrane calcium pump, ATP dependent, so very energy demanding. NCX is a sodium calcium exchanger. And then other pumps like your sodium potassium pump, right? So just think of that tissue beating all the time, right? And all that ion, all those ions moving for that electrical flow and depolarizing those cells. and then you have to regulate it for the next beat, next beat, next beat, versus the pacemaker and the contractile tissue, right? So think if there's any abnormality in the ion channels. Wow, that's going to affect how the heart functions, right? So it's pretty neat to think about. And so people actually look at the development of these channels. I don't want you to memorize the developmental times, but the concept here. These channels go amok, or they don't develop right, then you could actually pick up some of these earlier in development, because the pacing of the heart is dependent on these channels. So just to give you some idea, this is, remember what I stands for, current. So the current of this calcium late or long-lasting, transient calcium, the funny channel we talked about, remember that's that sodium channel that opens with hyperpolarization. So they can see that in development, that this is the expression of how this happens during development. And then as an adult, when you get older and you have defective hearts, they see abnormalities in the expression of these channels too. So it's just kind of interesting to think about over fetal development and old age, what can happen as these channels aren't. Remember, there's turnover of every protein in your body. Isn't that amazing? Every protein in your body, they have different turnover rates. I just find that mind-blowing. And how that then gets incorporated and functional, and the next protein's turning over, and you're turning over well as you're putting in new ones all the time. It's just, that's amazing. Cell biology is kind of cool. Okay. So lots of these loss of function mutations, and where do they look at some of these today? Rodent models, but also the second, well, it might be getting to be my best for crayfish and fruit flies. They look at fruit flies as well, because they can mimic these genetic mutations in Drosophila, and they can use gene therapy, put in the correct gene, see if it works, or you can express the correct gene and see over developmental time, is that pathology corrected? So there's lots of interesting aspects with this right now going on. Okay. So if you're ever interested in doing something else, if you're not interested in maybe going to medical school, but you want to contribute in health field, there's lots of different jobs out there, and they're really important too. Like we talked about, respiratory therapist, very critical, but also pediatric, look at this, echocardiology. They're actually technicians. They're not a cardiologist, but they can do these ultrasounds. Now they can send it online to a cardiologist that could be sitting at home in his bathrobe, right, or her bathrobe, reading the charts, and actually somebody can be recording all these things. So it's really amazing what's going on out there. If you get a chance to rotate around, you might want to try to rotate around with these different technicians as well, because they can teach you a lot. So it's pretty cool. Alrighty. I think we talked about all that. We talked about an elastic aorta before, an elasticity of pushing the blood into there, and then as it contracts down like a balloon, maintaining that flow. We mentioned that before, just to re-emphasize that. But if that was an issue, then you can imagine you can't maintain the flow well. Okay, so we should know some of these values generally. About 120 over 70, 120 over 80, right? And what do they call now with hypertension or pre-hypertensives? Anybody know the numbers for diastolic? Now it's like 90. If you're 90 or up, you might be pre-hypertensive, right, for diastolic pressure. So if you're go to the doc and they see that your blood pressure is, that the diastolic is above 90 or at 90, they're going to start to tell you, hey, do you smoke? Are you eating right? Are you sleeping right? Which probably none of us do. So that's part of it. So it's kind of interesting. If you want to calculate mean arterial pressure, there's a formula for this. And the formula that we might want to know is diastolic pressure plus one-third of the difference of systolic and diastolic pressure. Okay, so diastolic plus one-third times the difference of systole and diastole. And interesting, because that gives you a good index of how well the circulatory system's working. All right? Okay, so pulse pressure differences from diastole to systole. All right, so if you hear that word sometime later on, maybe, then you know that you can calculate, if you're given these values, you can calculate the mean pressure by plugging into that formula, diastole times one-third of the difference. Okay? And what's this little notch called again? Anybody remember what's that due to? If you were, this is a pressure wave, in the aorta, say, for example. They catheterize and they put it up, and it's right there in the aorta. Anybody remember what that little notch is due to? It's called the dicrotic notch. Standardized exams used to have this on there. So, you know, let you not miss this. Remember, ventricles contract, push blood's into the aorta, right? And then extends, and then the ventricle relaxes, so the blood's going to come back and bam, close that aortic valve. And you get that little pressure bounce. That's that little pressure bounce, all right? So that's the little pressure bounce called the dicrotic notch. If your valve wasn't working right, let's say it was defective, blood would then go back into the ventricle. You'd hear that swoosh. So this is the dub, lub, dub. This is the dub, right? Right, so this is the dub sound that you would hear closing those valves. Okay. We've talked about sympathetic. So if you look at the left ventricle, you see the pressure wave, boom, boom. You know, it's going to go all the way up to 120 because it has to exceed the pressure in the aorta, right? Gut into the aorta, push blood into the aorta. But when the ventricle relaxes, it's going to drop down to zero, and then blood's going to start flowing into it from the left atrium, right? And it can start flowing. Now, if we look at the arteries, large arteries like the aorta, this is your pressure that you would measure with the cuff on your arm, for example, systole and diastole. But look how quickly it drops as you go through the arterioles. So in old exams, the thing was, where does the pressure drop the most? And a lot of, if you have arterioles and you have another choice, capillaries, it's not the capillary bed. It's dropping the most in the arterioles, not the large arteries, but the arterioles. Why? Because you have the smooth muscle that can go around there and close it off, but they're becoming much smaller, right? So the pressure drop is really severe in the arterioles, and then as you go down the capillaries, veins, venules, inferior vena cava, for example, if it's out in your legs, and then back to the right atrium. Okay. So we'll just kind of skip through this stuff here, because we've talked about this. Oh, one thing I want to talk about here. It's going to come into respiratory chapter next, too. So if you're exercising your skeletal muscle, right, what's happening? The byproduct, temperature, right? We talked about that before. What's another thing? C6H12 plus 6 oxygens equals 6 waters, 6 CO2s. You didn't get those tattoos yet? Okay. That 6 CO2s, right, drops pH locally. So high temperature, low pH, right, is going to cause local vasodilation. So it causes local vasodilation. So your capillaries are going to dilate there, which is pretty neat because then it increases the blood flow to that exercising tissue. And this is the way they pick up even imaging in your brain if they're looking at blood flow to different regions. You start to do math, for example, and they're imaging your brain, they can see those centers that you're using to do that math problem, or you're thinking of something, there's actually a local change in blood flow. Isn't that cool? Very cool. And they can look at glucose uptake, and those cells will uptake glucose more. So this is how they can actually stain what cells are most highly active for whatever their use might be. Okay, so we talked about this generally. All right, so we can kind of skip this stuff. We've talked about sympathetic and parasympathetic a lot. You can look through these kind of diagrams. You know, it might be a lot in there, but basically they help you pull it together with the endocrine that we already covered and like these local factors that regulate blood flow to, say, tissue, either the heart or exercising skeletal muscle. So just look over these diagrams and say, oh, yeah, I got it. I know what it is, right? It helps you pull it all together. But I don't want to go through every diagram right here because we've covered these this content before quite a bit. Okay. The only other thing maybe we didn't talk about is cold. Cold causes vasoconstriction, right? So if you had a nosebleed, for example, and you couldn't get it to stop, what are you going to do? You know, you might pinch your nose, but you could also take ice cubes, ice pack, put it on your nose. That will help vasoconstrict. You probably experience this in the winter when you're outside and your fingers turn kind of whitish, right? Because you get local vasoconstriction. So cold causes vasoconstriction, basically to help maintain not having blood flow to that peripheral tissue that's cold and bringing back that cold blood to your body cavity, your core of your cavity. Okay. So let's talk about blood vessels and circulation a little bit. This is all the same stuff we've talked about quite a bit. Remember, you're getting glucose, oxygen exchange, right? CO2 taken up in the blood, and we'll cover more about how CO2 is transported in a little bit. But you remember your favorite equations. And so let's look at what happens in the capillary bed from here to there, for example. So if we had, I could draw it up here, but if we had a capillary bed, let's say this is arterial side over here on the right side, okay? And then we have a capillary bed across here, and then we have a venous side over here. We get high hydrostatic pressure here, right, on the arterial side. What's that going to do to the fluid, the water and the salts? Help push it out of the capillary bed into the interstitium, right, extracellular. So the major driving factor is the hydrostatic pressure on the arterial side of the capillary bed. As it goes through the capillary bed, what's happening to pressure, hydrostatic pressure? It's dropping, right? What's happening to the protein concentration in there, like albumin, in what we call the colloid osmotic pressure, like the proteins that aren't pushed through the endothelium? They're building up, right? So some textbooks show that that doesn't change, and other textbooks show it does change. It seems to be dependent on the tissue bed. But, get the concept down. Now we're on the venous side of the capillary bed. Hydrostatic pressure has dropped. Colloid osmotic pressure could increase depending on the tissue, right? Because albumin, now concentration's higher, right? Water went out, some salts went out. The albumin didn't go out, right? High proteins didn't go out. So that builds up on the inside the capillary. So now we have a higher osmotic gradient to pull fluid back into the capillary bed on the venous side. So you could have more of a colloid osmotic pressure contributing to reabsorption, because you've already pushed water out, and reabsorb on the venous side of the capillary bed and then going out. Now, some textbooks show that colloid osmotic pressure doesn't change as you go through the capillary bed. So I don't want you to be confused. It seems to depend on the tissue. But you can imagine the experiments that people try to measure taking the blood out in the different regions. And a lot of that has been done by actually putting an oil droplet in and letting that oil droplet go through and then sampling as it goes through, you know, past the oil droplets or a patch of fluid that you put through in an experimental model. So it's kind of interesting to think about. But these sphincters in the arterioles can actually close off and then direct blood flow to a particular tissue or different regions of the tissue. All right? So that's something to think about as well. All right, so if we look at this diagram, this is a good diagram to kind of look over and think about. So here's blood flow rate, liters per minute, right? So the flow through all your tissue is about 5 liters a minute. So that's your whole volume of blood, right? You have about 5 liters of blood, maybe a bit more in some people because of the size of you. So about 5 liters, but think, every minute, that's all going through your heart, right? And through your whole body and coming back around. But if you add up all the capillary beds, it's the total, right? It stays the same amount as it goes through the closed system. If we look at the cross-sectional area of any region, this was on old exams, the aorta is the biggest vessel, right? So it's a big cross-sectional area. But then as you go down through the arterioles and the capillary beds, since you have so many capillaries, if you took a cross-section through all the capillaries, and this appears on standardized exams too, if you took a cross-section through all the capillaries, and you added up the cross-sectional area of all the capillaries, it's a tremendous amount of area. So here you see the cross-sectional area, the total cross-sectional area, not of an individual vessel, but total, is very large in the capillary beds. And you can imagine why. Gas exchange, right? You need small little vessels, so you don't want a thick wall there, right? So you can have very good gas exchange and nutrient exchange. And then you look at the velocity of flow, and of course it's going to drop as you branch that hose up to many little branches, and that velocity picks back up as all those little branches come back to the venous side. So velocity is dropping in the capillary beds, which is good because then it has time to get the gas exchange and nutrient exchange, waste products back and forth, and then it picks back up. Because remember, in the aorta or in the venules, it's not really for gas exchange or nutrient exchange. Okay, so it basically covered all that. And here's this figure that I just schematically kind of got you in the mindset. So this little pi symbol is for anaconic pressure. you can kind of go through this and think about it. Now, here's a figure where they showed anaconic pressure didn't change. All right? But because hydrostatic pressure did change, so here's hydrostatic pressure on our arterial side. You see, that's pushing most of the fluid out. So the major contributor on the arterial side of the capillary bed is hydrostatic pressure. As the pressure drops, the gradient for anaconic pressure is increased. Now, some textbooks show that this value actually increases. But because hydrostatic pressures drop so much, the net take-home, regardless of anaconic pressure changes that much or not, is that it's a promoting reabsorption on the venous side of the capillary bed, because it's always a difference of hydrostatic and anaconic pressure. Okay? And then what happens to that fluid in the interstitium, like between your muscle cells? It's taken up in the lymphatic system, right? And so the lymphatic system is really important. It has like these open little flaps where fluid can just come in, right? It's not like holes that are regulated. It's just like a flap. So if you had these in a, you know, inside the tissue bed and the fluid's building up, then it can just kind of flow right in, right? And the lymphatic system, it's mobilized in us because of muscle contraction, all right? Movement. In some animals, we kind of quickly went over that. I think we might have a slide. They actually have lymphatic hearts, a heart that actually beats in the lymphatic system and pushes blood through the lymphatic system. That's pretty cool. We don't have that, so it's mobilized through movements of your muscles. All right, so lymph. And we know why the lymph system is really important, right? If you take immunology, I think it's a great course to take immunology and virology to get a chance, because you really learn a lot. Remember, this is the detecting of foreign bodies like bacteria, viruses, whatever, might be as a foreign substance, so you can activate the lymphatic system and your immune response. So it's really the army of the body to protect, okay? And it can actually absorb fat also and then get it back in. So where does the lymph system go? I think we have a picture here somewhere coming up. Here's those little flaps that we were talking about. It goes into it. And now you see the lymphatic system taking in fluid from different tissues and lymph nodes, right? And you have more entry in the lymph node and then exiting the lymph nodes usually less, so it can actually perfuse over all that tissue and make sure to detect any foreign substances and trigger an immune response like white blood cells or a secondary immune response. And then that dumps back in to your circulatory system. So it dumps back in before it enters back into the heart. So now you have a mixing of the lymph and the systemic venous return, and then that gets mixed back in and then back into the circulatory system. And it all goes over again and again. Pretty neat. They used to think that there was no lymphatic system in the brain. Right? In the brain. And you probably heard of this. You know, it was a big thing about 2 years ago. Glial lymph. Glia, because of the glia in the brain. And glial lymphatic system. A gal at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, described that she was actually imaging in rodent brains, and she noticed when they slept that there was an increase in perfusion. So she thought, well, why is that? So it was a big thing. It hit really big news. She was from Denmark, and now she went back to Denmark because she thought, and people told her, she's probably going to get a Nobel Prize. So she wanted to go back to her home country so she'll be recognized from Denmark as getting a Nobel Prize. And who knows if she's really going to get it or not, but she took this gamble. But now people are questioning, maybe it's not so straightforward as was meant to be, or what was perceived. And actually some people had noted that before her, and it was actually written up in publications. So now it kind of comes a bit more. But what's interesting, the take-home of this, is that that glial lymph, that fluid flow between the arterial side and the venous side, going through the brain, it picks up amyloid plaques. Once amyloid plaques get into the circulatory system, they're degraded very quickly. So now what happens if you don't have the glial lymph so much, the glial flow, this lymphatic flow? Amyloid plaques build up. Alzheimer's patients have problems. Remember glial? These amyloid plaques are related with Alzheimer's. They don't sleep as much, so maybe there's some problems. Is it a cause or an effect, right? So that's kind of interesting. But this is opening up a whole new research area in this glial lymph and the impact that it has in washing out substances in the brain. But so now you have to kind of change the context. That's the beauty of science. As more things are discovered, you come up with new ideas and keep looking at it. So it's always moving, right? So it's kind of interesting. So there might be a lymphatic system in the brain. What happens with elephantitis if you can't get circulation going? You get this disease called elephantitis. It's a parasitic infection that blocks the lymph, and you can see these things. It's kind of problematic. Here's a scrotum that built up, so that's even flow. Same thing with other tissue. It's all due to that little crazy little parasitic thing there. And it can be treated. If you get the medications, you can kill it out. But it's all from this mosquito that can actually carry this parasite and get it into people. So it still goes on in some countries, not treated because they can't get, you know, the medication. But, of course, they try to get in there and do things. But mosquitoes can do so much. And now there's, you know, a lot of controversy with the global climate change and vectors that are spreading further north that used to not spread further north, and problems with mosquito survival because of climate change. All right, so things to think about. If we talk about capillary beds, there's, you know, to get the nutrients out and gases exchange, but you don't want red blood cells just to pop out into the interstitium. So, and like a continuous capillary, this is the type of capillary bed that's in your muscle, okay? All right, you can think about that in your muscle. Very small, you don't have to memorize the numbers, but the general content, small, but continuous capillary for small molecules to exchange with the tissue around it. And then you get these larger gaps in the endothelium, and this is like in your kidneys, for example, where you need larger molecules to go across the capillary bed. And then you get these sinusoidal capillaries where you can actually get red blood cells to move across. Where do we see that? In the bone, right? Because in your bones is where you make red blood cells. And so you have to get that those red blood cells into the circulatory system so you see these large gaps. Okay, so that's the main point. You can kind of go through these diagrams. They're just there. They're on their PowerPoint, but we already covered these pretty much. And so I'm just going to skip right on through this because we've covered this. We've talked about the muscles helping with movement of blood and lymph, for example. You can look through these diagrams. They're really good to look through to help you understand cardiac output. And remember, we talked about cardiac output. How do we measure it? If you're going to index it, heart rate times stroke volume, right? Heart rate times stroke volume. And then you can think about the factors that go into regulating heart rate, sympathetic, parasympathetic, and what regulates stroke volume. And then you can think about what regulates cardiac output. So you can go through these diagrams. I suggest you go through there just to kind of put it all in context. If you had an open response question on a quiz or something like that, then you could at least draw some of the arrows. But conceptually, I think it's not that hard conceptually to think about this, right? Right? We got it down. So it's not like you have to memorize everything. Just think about it. Okay, so we've already talked about all this stuff. There's our little baboon heart. Okay. And blood. So these are all the same things about what's in those other diagrams. So I'm just going to cruise through there. The other thing that just to remember is how do you measure blood pressure, right, to regulate? We talked about pH, CO2, carotid bodies, right? pH and CO2. Carotid sinus for pressure, right? So think of sinus headache, pressure, carotid sinuses. That way you can think about these corny analogies, right? I don't know if we talked about it before, but I think we might have. There was a case in China a number of years back. They just got married, and then the lady actually passed out and died from this, but they found out why, because they, on their honeymoon night, and that was a sad case, they were kissing and maybe got a little bit carried away, and kissing too hard on the neck, necking, you know, and then pushing on the carotid sinus. It's also a problem if you wear two type of collars, for example. Pushing on the carotid sinus then signals what? You have a high blood pressure. So what's that going to do? Try to slow down the heart. Some people are more sensitive to that than others. It was probably a very extreme case of being extra sensitive, but it was a great educational concept. So when my daughter was in high school, I could say, look what happens if you go out kissing her, necking. So it was a way to, you know, my daughter's probably has a traumatic experience for my sayings. But anyways, you can now imagine not to push in the neck. And some people do these crazy things where they actually hold each other to try to pass out, and they think it's really cool, but it could be quite dangerous, right? Because you push on the carotid sinuses and could damage them too. So watch out for these kind of crazy things people do. Okay, so we finished that. Now we can cruise on respiratory. And I know I'd have a little bit of a mind change, but it's all the same pretty much, right? We just cover system by system by system. So if we talk about respiration, what are we trying to do? Comparatively, right? Get gas, this is to exchange, right? And now you think about what kind of gases? Oxygen, CO2 primarily, right? But you also have to think about nitrogen also, right? And so that's kind of interesting to think about. Small animals, diffusion, right? We, you know, a real small animal, you don't need it respiratory structures, right, to get it into the deep tissue because it's so small. It can just diffuse across the membrane and get right into the tissue if it's relatively small. But as an animal develops and the tissue gets thicker and thicker, then you start to see more of a respiratory system developing. Along with, what else? The cardiovascular system. So they go hand in hand, pretty much. But some other interesting aspects to think about gas and think about animals that live in the water versus air-breathing animals, right? And then they have to get the gas out of the water into their bloodstream. So how well can you dissolve gases in water? So this is kind of interesting. The solubility of gases in distilled water with temperature. So the colder the temperature, more gas can get in there, right? Can be in there, solubility. The same with oxygen, the same with CO2, all right? And we're missing some numbers down there. But the main idea is higher solubility of these gases with lower temperatures. So think about that heterothermic animal, right? In the cold water, like the Arctic water, versus the equator water, right? Where it's warmer, maybe. So what might be the differences? In your power, or somewhere on the webpage, I have this nice little article that you can download on Arctic fish. Didn't we cover something about that a little bit? I think we talked about it, right? Arctic fish, there's this fish that they found down in the Arctic, in the South Pole area, that when they pulled it up, it died relatively quickly, and they couldn't figure out why it died so quickly. They actually found out more about this fish. It's really amazing. It has no hemoglobin. No hemoglobin. No red blood cells. It doesn't need it because it lives only in cold water and the oxygen solubility is very high. So it just has to get oxygen into its blood and that's how it then gets oxygen to its tissue. So it doesn't need hemoglobin. It doesn't even need red blood cells. The vessels are actually larger than analogous fish. But if it starts to go to warm water, what happens? It dies because it doesn't have the solubility of the oxygen in the water because it's too warm. So what happens if you heat up water? Movement, right? Particle movement. And then that's not going to allow the solubility of the gases in the water. So if somebody drowns, and you hear about these cases all the time, right, especially in the summertime and things, if a child falls in a pool or in the ocean, there's some different issues, right? So let's say you might have heard of the cases where the kid's up in Canada or something, fishing with grandpa, the cold water goes on the face. What happens with cold water on the face? Diving reflex, right? Your heart rate slows down. So younger people are more sensitive to that. So cold water on the face, diving response, kind of got dizzy, passed out in just shallow water, and then the water gets in the lungs and they drowned. But then they were under the water for 20 minutes, they got out, did CPR, and the person's fine. But if that happens down in Florida, in the warm water, you don't hear of the survival. And it's because of the gas exchange of solubility of oxygen in the cold water is much higher than it is in warm water. So the survival rate is much better in fresh, cold water. Now, let's just go to the north somewhere, it's cold ocean water and cold fresh water. Which one's more likely going to survive if they drown? Well, this solubility of gas in salinity, if you take the salinity and you go higher from, let's say it's 0 degrees, you see as you add more salt, the solubility decreases. So you're less likely to survive in salt, cold salt water than you would in cold fresh water because of solubility of gases. This is why it's important to understand these gases. And people also are trying to develop artificial blood, right? And you've probably heard of cold-induced comas. And you can think about all these issues that go around with healthcare as well. And so it's quite interesting. But the main take-home here is cold, increased gas solubility. Salinity decreases gas solubility at the same temperature. Okay. And then we go to altitude. What happens if we're going to climb Mount Everest? And you hear of these stories. There's some really great books if you're interested in extreme medicine. One written by a guy named Fong. He's an MD. Got really interested in extreme medicine and the cares that go around it. And you probably hear of these people climbing Mount Everest. And some people are a little crazy about doing this. So what they do is they work at base camp for a little bit, find out if they can handle it, right? They're ready to make the ascent up Mount Everest really fast in a day. They run up there as fast as they can, you know, do the flagpole or whatever, and then come back down. And some people do it without any gas tanks or any kind of respiratory devices. And they might make it if they're in good shape. So they go up, but then all of a sudden a storm comes, which they can't predict. What happens when the storm occurs? What happens to barometric pressure when you have a thunderstorm? It drops. When barometric pressure drops, the partial pressure of gases drops. We'll see why. So then the oxygen level drops too low, and then they die because they weren't expecting the storm to come up. And it happens all the time, and it's usually because of these storms. So if you read these stories, it's really neat relationship, some sad things. And they supposedly just leave the bodies on the side. It's part of the whole deal going to Mount Everest. Okay, so as you go up in altitude, the barometric pressure drops. So the normal ceiling to get enough oxygen into your body, you need so much pressure to help push oxygen into your blood. Then you can't function. And so these are partial pressure or arterial or alveolar oxygen. And then you can see that you will need, you know, like pure oxygen. So this is an important thing. You see, like, pilots in the movies, you know, injecting out of the plane, those 007 movies, right? And they have a little oxygen on their mask or something because they need it if they jump out too high. But if they jump out low enough, barometric pressure is really low, high altitude, right? They might survive. But if you jump out of the plane at too high, you're going to die, even if you have your parachute, because you can't get oxygenation into your bloodstream. So this is why the gas mask or holding the gas oxygen tanks to breathe. Okay, so the general idea then, barometric pressure related with that. So how do you calculate these partial pressures? Let's just do oxygen, for example. You do it with any of the gases, nitrogen, CO2. So the partial pressure of oxygen at sea level, what's the sea level? Remember all that from chemistry that you purged and forgot? Right, barometric pressure chemistry, 760, right? 760 mercuries and millimeters of mercury, right? Although no one measures with mercury anymore. But times the percent of that gas. So oxygen is about 21%, right? In this case, 0.2094. So you get about 159 millimeters of mercury of pressure for oxygen at sea level. But as that gas comes into your lungs, moisture's there. Right? So generally, they subtract out about 18 from the barometric pressure. So 760 minus 18, now that's the barometric pressure of what's going on in your lungs due to the moisture. That's because the moisture takes up some of the oxygen. So then you minus 18 times the gas, and so you have about 155 millimeters of mercury. Okay. So that's kind of interesting to think about. And we'll go back over this again. So that's the pressure pushing oxygen into your blood. All right. So if barometric pressure drops, right, then that whole equation drops. So you should be able to figure this out for whatever gas we give you, and if we gave you the percents of nitrogen or CO2 or oxygen and what barometric pressure is. So it's kind of interesting when you think about these factors with altitude. All right, so let's think about the other kind of extreme case. What about going in the ocean? And you go down, right? You go further down. Barometric pressure builds up, right? As you go deeper and deeper and deeper. Okay. So as you go really deep, the ambient pressure increases quite a bit. So anybody scuba dive? Something? Maybe? Try one time? People dive all the time, like when they go to the Caribbean, and they're going to have that 5-minute scuba diving lesson, and they get, oh, yeah, this is great. And they die. they signed waivers, so the companies don't care. And so, but you hear about this all the time. So if you really want to scuba dive and stuff, get certified. And there's lots of different certifications. There's basic, advanced. The NAWI is really a good one. That's by the U.S. Navy. And so they, diving charts. So you look at a diving chart, and maybe you want to go to Carter Lake up here and dive. You got these tanks, and you learned how to dive when you were down at the Caribbean, and you think, okay, I'm going to buy scuba tanks, and I'm going to go to Carter Lake and dive. But it's a totally different story. Because why? You're at altitude. And the altitude affects the amount of partial pressure in the surrounding area. So that's going to be a factor to think. So these diving tables work about the pressures that you're with. Okay, so think that you're down in the water, you're breathing through a compressed gas. All right, so you're breathing through compressed gas. And you're down deep in the water now. Oops, I was following that little fish, and I was playing with that little echinoderm, and my tank's out all of a sudden, and so it's okay. I'll just hold my breath and swim up really fast to the top of the surface. But you breathed in from compressed gas. So think, you have a lot of barometric pressure pushing down your lungs, right? You breathed in some compressed gas, and you hold your breath. And now you're surfacing. But what happened to the pressure around you? Yeah, it goes down. So what happens to your lungs? It fills up, it expands. And if you don't blow out fast enough, what happens when you surface? Your lungs just get blown out of your mouth, and you die right there. So that's a big problem. And so what usually scuba divers know, not to go any faster than the smallest bubble. You blow bubbles, and you don't go any faster than the smallest bubble that's going out, and you blow out if you had to run out of gas. But you probably heard of these people that actually die for a long period of time. Good pay for people to work on oil rigs, like in the Gulf Coast of Texas. And what's the issue here? Lots of things. So they're working down a long time on a rig, and they might be doing welding. Pay really great. So then they're doing welding, but they stay down so long that their pressures are really changed, and they build up nitrogen in their body. They build up this nitrogen in their body. So nitrogen gets into their fat tissue. And so when they start to surface, if they come up too quickly, all those nitrogen gas bubbles that are all over in their fat, in their brain, in their heart, in their muscles, what's going to happen to those little nitrogen gas bubbles if they don't blow out? When you surface, what's going to happen? They get bigger. So you get what's called nitrogen narcosis, because you can't get the nitrogen gas out. And so the stories are that it sounds like the bubble wrap. You know, you like to pop it, right? It sounds like bubble wrap breaking all over their body. So these little bubbles that are forming all over in their tissue, in their heart, in their brain, in their skeletal muscle, all those little bubbles popping. So it's a big problem. So let's say that it came up too quick. They didn't decompress as they were coming up. So these people have tanks on a rope, and they will go up to a certain level, and they will stay there and continue to breathe in and out, breathe in and out, blow the gases out, let those bubbles dissolve into their circulatory system and blow it out. And then they go up to another level, and they wait there. So these tanks are on a rope, so they know how long they have to be at each level before they can surface. And that's why they're paid so much. And they have certain rules now about how many hours you can be under, you know, under the water and do all those kind of things. You wonder if they really pay attention to that, you know, because they're paid and, you know, they got to get work done. And then you think about these oil leaks that happen, and they get divers down in there. Lots of things like this. So there's response teams that do this. So what happens? So this guy has nitrogen narcosis, or gal. They have nitrogen narcosis. They surface, and the oil rig company says, oh, wow, we got to get into a decompression chamber. So they get the helicopter on the pad, pick him up. What happened now? They just went higher in altitude, right? Made it even worse. And then they get to Houston or something and go into a decompression chamber where they put the pressure back on the person so they can breathe out. But they just made it worse by getting there. So now the companies actually have decompression chambers on oil rigs out there, so they can just fly over to another oil rig that has all that stuff on there to treat them right out of the place.
I used to fly helicopters in the Navy. Mm-hmm. When they pick up scuba divers, you get special clearance to fly as low as possible.
To try to keep it down as low as possible. So that's really important, like you just mentioned, to fly those helicopters low as possible. But it's a great idea to have those right there close by, right? So even some scuba diving vessels that are made with lots of scuba divers will have decompression tanks on their boat. Now, think about that five-minute lesson that you had on the Caribbean cruise ship. And they tell you all this, and you're like, oh, yeah, this is great. And you're just going to go down and do it, right? You can get nitrogen narcosis, and you can have this lung problem in a pool. Like if you were practicing scuba diving in the pool here, and you're getting a lesson, it's just as bad. Because if you breathe that gas in compressed, and you're at the bottom of there, and you surface, it's a problem. Okay, so something really practical to think about with these gases. It's really important for other aspects, too. And pay attention if you're really going to get a license. So in us, we use hemoglobin, and one globular unit of that heme is like this, and iron is that molecule that binds oxygen, right? And so if we talk about hemoglobins, the types of hemoglobin, fetal hemoglobin has a stronger binding affinity than the maternal hemoglobin. Why? Because you need to pull that oxygen off the mother's blood, right, into the fetus, so the fetus can have that oxygen. So it's really quite interesting. They make different forms of the hemoglobin. And those different forms then have different affinities for oxygen. So they need to take that away from the mother, so it has a higher binding affinity, but it also then a higher percentage. And as the baby's born, fetal hemoglobin, you change the type of hemoglobin that you make, and then you make adult hemoglobin. You don't have to memorize different chains, just the idea of fetal hemoglobin and adult hemoglobin is different. And the binding affinity is different. So here are oxygen saturation curves. These are really quite neat. We'll talk more about them as we go along. But how to read these. So the way to do this, and when we talk more about it, remember, you're going to look at the partial pressure of whatever the gas. This could be for CO2. This could be for nitrogen. This could be for oxygen. In this case, it's oxygen. So partial pressure of oxygen, let's say it's 30 here. We go up the line and then cross over. So this first one, which is postnatal, 81, and you go this way, and you see that it's about 60. And that's the oxygen saturation. All right, so it's about 60. Now, if you look at the fetus, and you go up 30, wow, it's about 70. So what that means is the amount of oxygen that's saturated in the hemoglobin. So it has a better affinity for oxygen, has a higher saturation at the same pressure, okay, at the same partial pressure of oxygen. So that tells you it has a greater affinity. Okay, so that's really neat. There was something here I wanted to say. Oh, how do they do these kind of experiments? It's really cool. They take the blood out, put it into like a rock tumbler, if anybody ever smooth rocks, right? These little things that roll back around, and you put sand in there and make smooth rocks. You ever do that in high school? No? Okay. Deprived. So it's kind of neat. They put that basically on a rock tumbler, a glass jar that rotates around, and they have these tubes in there, and they make the blood very thin on the surface of the glass. So it rotates around, and they can then go in and take samples of the blood as the gas goes through. So you can have different partial pressures. And then they sample and find out what the percent of that oxygen saturation is of that blood. And then they can change the gases in there. So it's a very thin coating, and they can measure that. It's pretty cool. Maybe I can get a YouTube video of that. That's pretty neat. So here is another case of this oxygen, what we call oxygen dissociation curve, or oxygen percent oxygen saturation curve. So here we look at hemoglobin and myoglobin. Remember, myoglobin's in your muscles, right? So what do you want to do? You want to pull oxygen off your hemoglobin, right, into the muscles so you can have gas exchange for the mitochondria, right? Mitochondria ATP production. So if we look up here, let's say 30 again, hemoglobin, only 40% saturation, right, at, let's say, 30. Depends where you're looking. And then you go up to myoglobin, and you think, wow, myoglobin has a much greater affinity, more saturation. So that can really pull the oxygen out of the blood into the skeletal muscle and then deliver it to, say, the mitochondria for making ATP. Now, what's the difference between hemoglobin and myoglobin in structure? What did we talk about? Remember this test question a long time ago? Myoglobin is one globular unit. Hemoglobin is four globular units that come together. And so something else really important about this curve is that you see myoglobin goes up pretty linear and then over. So it saturates very quickly and then it's flat, right? But what about hemoglobin? It has this S-shaped curve. This S-shaped curve is due to cooperativity. Test question on standardized exams. So why is this S-shaped curve? What does it mean? Cooperativity. As one option binds, the next one can bind at more affinity. The next one can bind more affinity. So it will bind at a more efficiency or a greater affinity with more oxygen binding to the hemoglobin. Okay? So you got four. It's similar to what we talked about a long time ago with the calcium binding protein that's in your synapses in the presynaptic nerve terminal. Remember, synaptotagmin has four binding domains? As one calcium binds, it actually increases the affinity of the other. So it actually has cooperativity too. That's why that residual calcium is so important after synaptic transmission. You can have just a little bit more and you get more vesicles that fuse because you already have some synaptotagmin with calcium that's lingering around versus if there wasn't any. So it's the same idea. That's cooperativity. Okay, so the other factor that's really cool is pH effects on oxygen saturation or oxygen affinity. Think of that exercise in skeletal muscle. You don't have to memorize these. Just think of the concept. What do you want to do with exercise in skeletal muscle? You want oxygen to come in, right? You want oxygen to come into your skeletal muscle. So myoglobin's pulling it in, but how else can you help to decrease the binding affinity of oxygen to hemoglobin? Temperature and pH. So what happens as the exercise in skeletal muscle makes CO2? What happens to pH? It drops. So if you have pH of 7.2 compared to 7.6, which one has a greater binding affinity? Hemoglobin with pH 7.6 or hemoglobin in pH 7.2? 7.4 has a greater binding affinity. So as the pH drops, the CO2 rises, you're going to try to have oxygen to come off of hemoglobin so then it can be taken up by the myoglobin in the muscle, right? So it all makes sense. It's pretty cool. All right? And that helps getting that across. And so you see not only that, but you see then the pH related with CO2 and at that particular temperature. Okay. And so that's pretty neat to think about. Also, temperature has an effect too. So there's and something else on this oxygen saturation. Remember the finger thing that we did? Remember, we put that on the finger. Was it in the outreach center or was it up here? First day of class, I think, right? And we measured oxygen saturation, the partial pressure of oxygen saturation, which can tell you so much, right? But it can be a misconception too, right? What's the misconception? It just tells you percent saturation. So maybe you're 98%, but you're looking bluish, right? You're not getting good oxygenation to your tissue. How can that happen? You're 98%. All right, what's the take home here? What are we missing? It's a saturation. It's not absolute, right? So let's say you have anemia. Let's say you had an abdominal aneurysm, right? And you're bleeding out into your abdomen. And your blood isn't circulating, not as much blood is circulating, but the percent saturation might be the same. Or if you're anemic and you're not making red blood cells, right? You're anemic. But the amount of blood that you have is highly saturated. So you can see where you can be confused by that little finger thing unless you measure your hematocrit along with it, right? So that's why that hematocrit is important as well. So these shifts that we talk about, this shift to the right or left. So remember, this is what standardized exams will actually test you. Say, is it a rightward shift of the oxygen dissociation curve or is it a leftward shift? So with low pH, it's a right shift, right? That increases affinity. If it's a left shift, it decreases affinity. So pH, low pH promotes a rightward shift. Higher pH promotes a leftward shift. So this is called the Bohr effect. The Bohr effect, okay? So the Bohr effect is related with pH. CO2 and the total amount of, if you have more CO2 around, that can actually carboxy hemoglobin. That can decrease the amount of oxygen that will bind to hemoglobin. And so that is another factor. If CO2 is high, it actually decreases, not just because of the pH, but it's carboxy hemoglobin, and it decreases the amount of oxygen that can bind to hemoglobin. Okay, so we talk about these in general. So think about the lungs, getting gas exchange, right? Building up oxygen, going through the tissue. You're going to decrease the oxygen level because oxygen is going to the tissue. And so you have lower partial pressure of oxygen as you come back around, and then you pick it back up in the lungs. But just the opposite for CO2, right? Because you pick up CO2 in the tissue bed, and then it gets lost out in the lungs, and then it's low as it comes back in the artery. So these gases, we've already talked about these. You should know, let's go through some of these. We already talked about nitrogen is about 80%, oxygen is about 21%. We talked about skin before, and gills in the fish, these cute little animals that you can look at, really cute. All right, so we will stop here. I will put the rest of an hour, 15 minutes or whatever it is, on echo. We will probably get pretty good through respiratory. I'm just going through the PowerPoint, but I will just put it in verbal terms because there's a lot of extra information in some of these PowerPoints, but the main point that we should know, okay, in the podcast as well. I will probably try to post that tonight, so you'll have it next Tuesday in case you're bored and you just wanted to listen to it at the same time. You can do so.